Hello, I'm Mischievous Mark Giannacchio, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, Amazing Fantasy number 15, and of course, all of the Amazing Spider-Man annuals, which I say do not count, including the one I posted on my Instagram today, which was Amazing Spider-Man Annual 9, Dan, a reprint of Spectacular Spider-Man Magazine number 2. That definitely doesn't count.
You got to get it for that cover, though, man. That's a sweet, like, remake of a cover.
Yeah, I love just getting things for the cover and spending Silver Age comic book prices for them, Dan.
Oh, please. Like, you haven't spent that on a variant in the past few months.
All right.
They even added that weird web across the cover that Spider-Man seems to be precariously balancing on. That's not in the Spider-Man magazine cover. If you don't know what we're looking at, go look up that annual and you'll see what I'm talking about. In the meantime, though, I'm Dapper Dan Gavastin and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, including the annuals, which I say definitely count, including that sweet, sweet cover, that remake of, what is it, Spectacular Spider-Man Magazine number 2. For me, Amazing Fantasy 15 will remain a fantasy.
Well, thank goodness for that. Well, no, I shouldn't say thank goodness for that, Dan. I'm cheering for you, even with your stubbornness towards annuals. I do cheer for you for one day your fantasy to no longer be a fantasy. But in the meantime, welcome to the Amazing Spider Talk, the show where two fans and collectors uncover the strange, fun, and fascinating history of the Spider-Man comic universe. Thanks for joining us for this review episode of the Amazing Spider Talk.
Yeah, and if you want to swing along with us on our journey through Spidey's past, present, and future, subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review to help spread the word about our show.
This podcast exists because of the support of our Patreon members. If you want to receive early episodes, exclusive artwork, and just keep this podcast going, please go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and consider joining our Patreon.
Yeah, and today on the show, Mark and I are going to be discussing Amazing Spider-Man Volume 6, Number 45. That's Legacy 939, even though on the cover it says Legacy 938. Slip up from the Spider office there. Not a big deal, but a funny one. This issue is written by Zeb Wells. The cover features artwork by John Romita Jr., Scott Hanna, and Marcio Menez. And the interior artwork is by Carmen Carnero, with colors by Marcio Menez, and of course, letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. This issue was first released on March 13th, 2024. Mark, hit us with your recap of this issue.
Thank you, Dan. We open at the Ravencroft Institute for the Criminally Insane. Dinner is being served to such luminaries as Hippo and Mr. Hyde, except Mr. Hyde isn't in the Roger Stern era, so he would like to be called his alter ego, Calvin Zabo. When the nurse doesn't oblige, he threatens to tear her in half and make stew from the meat. And now somewhere, the spirit of Carl Weathers is talking about making a stew. With a wink and a nod, the nurse says that no one is in Ravencroft that doesn't belong, just as Spider-Man is wall-crawling above her. Oh, the irony. In fact, the nurse is going to visit Anna Watson next, and boy is Anna in a terrible mood, saying many variants of the word priss before saying the nurse is wearing the ugliest doily she's ever seen. Hold my pearls, Dan. We're reminded that Anna took Krakoan medicine that was tainted, and as soon as there's a cure, she'll be the first to know. Right on cue, Spider-Man is here to deliver that cure. Anna is resistant, but Spider-Man convinces her it's what will best treat KSD, Krakoan Derangement Syndrome, for those of you not in Nick Lowe's brain.
Thanks, Anna Trump.
Warp speed, Dan. Anna goes from ragey to earnest and scared, and it looks like she's ready to accept before turning evil again and biting Spider-Man's hand. That leads to Spidey injecting her and Anna realizing she's been threatening to kill everyone for quite some time, and even though she doesn't actually want to, Spider-Man wants to bust her out, but Anna feels like it's her responsibility to stay, which drives Peter mad, but he gets it. Flash over to Oscorp. Remember Norman Osborn? Well, he's back, folks. Not in POG form, just in comic form. And he's reminding us he took a few issues off because he had a business to attend to during the gang war. Hand wave. Norman tells Peter it's good he didn't physically break out Anna because there's not a legal team alive that could defend that. And it's good to see some legit lawyer logic finally seeping its way into the pages of a Marvel comic book. Take that, She-Hulk. Peter wants to turn in his resignation, but Norman's indignant. Peter reminds him that it was basically Norman's idea since Spider-Man business with taking over Oscorp, but Norman apologizes for being so snippy about all that. So now with the Anti-Vigilante Act off the books, Peter can go back to doing Spider-Man business, and Norman might take that old gold goblin attire out for a spin more often. Peter is so, oh gosh, taken aback by Norman that he gives him a nice dreamy look, and then they take a walk to the cafeteria.
Aww.
That brings us to Kurt Connors going into a clean room and seeing Doug and Kyle, and Kurt is outraged that Doug has a phone in the clean room. He doesn't care if it's in airplane mode. We get some science mumbo-jumbo that I'm sure is important, and that Dan is going to insist I spell out in my synopsis, but I don't care. We then name-check the living brain, and then see an actual giant brain, and that sure looks ominous. Over to the outskirts of Ravencroft, and Spidey is meeting up with MJ, Jackpot, when she's on her superhero duty, mind you. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is still a thing that's happening. Anyway, Jackpot is just out fighting crime like any other average superhero, and Peter's trying so dang hard to be supportive. Or maybe it's just me, the reader, trying to actually accept this is the status quo. Either way, the two change and they're over to Ravencroft, where Anna is arm in arm with a doctor, getting led around the institute, just being so kind to everyone. Peter is acting a bit shell-shocked by the whole thing, and Anna scolds him for not having a more open mind about being nice to the criminals and murderers. MJ wants to take Anna home, and the doctors let her know that the time to do that is close. We get some awkward exposition to remind everyone that Peter and MJ were dating, but not anymore, because she likes to take cuckolds from other dimensions. And anyway, Peter's wandering eye spots the Sandman sitting alone in the cafeteria. He addresses him as William Baker, and Sandman wants to know who told him to call him that. Peter says a friend named Spider-Man, in fact, and boy, that's not a great answer. Sandman soliloquies about being made of good parts of sand and bad parts of sand before the name Spider-Man just sets him off into a rage. He turns into his sand monster self, but then the dampeners hold him off from going full psycho. MJ looks up at the ruckus and tells Peter they should leave, but before they do, Marco grabs Peter by the hand and tells him in addition to the bad sand, someone else wants Spider-Man out as well, which brings us over to a visual of the Sinister Six, with Doc Ock leading the way. Dun, dun, dun.
Throughout Gang War, we kind of lamented the lack of Spider-Man and his narration guiding the story forward, and how that ultimately kind of was the biggest detriment to that story for us, that it didn't really have a Spider-Man tale at the heart of it. We get to this two-issue like side story with art from Carmen Carnero that sees Spider-Man going to Ravencroft, as you just detailed. Even in the back of this issue, Nick Lowe points out that this is one of those classic check-in on everybody issues that we've kind of become acquainted with. Did you find this a refreshing palate cleanser or a like reversion to norm for the Amazing Spider-Man title?
Yes, to a degree. I guess I am, you know, not to be the cynic of the two of us, Dan, but, you know, we are who we are, so I might as well just be a little cynical. Like, I don't want to, like, give this whole thing too much credit for like doing what this book should just be doing, like it was breathing anyway. You know what I mean? Like we should always be in Peter's head. We should always be checking in with Peter's supporting cast. The supporting cast is so vital to the world of Spider-Man. And in fact, a key member of that supporting cast was on his deathbed in Gang War, and we barely got check-ins about it. Or it was just kind of like, and my friend Randy's almost dead. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, to kind of go back to some phraseology we used during parts of the Dan Slott era, I don't want to get into grading this on a curve too much. I mean, yes, this was definitely a welcomed return to what this book should be doing. And there were some really nice character moments in here. I mean, there were also a lot of moments that were frankly built around some absurdities, like Anna Watson in a mental institute because she's got a Krakoan virus in her. And, you know, Peter and MJ kind of doing a dalliance over their superhero identities because MJ's a superhero. So, like, before we go and like, hey, you know, old school Roger Stern and DeFalco Spider-Man is back. We're not quite there yet, guys. You know what I mean? Like, this was a nice character-centric move, but I mean, you know, there's still some things there where I'm like, okay, you know, this is still where this book's at right now. You know, like,
yeah, I feel very similar to you, but I do think something like this, you know, is like you said, it's kind of the platonic ideal of what your average modern Spider-Man comic should be, right? And I say average by that because like this is the kind of book you might pick up in the 1970s. Like it is Peter going about doing his stuff, and maybe there's a small fight in it somewhere, but it is largely character oriented. And like again, that you know that it might be faint praise, but like this is the kind of book that Amazing Spider-Man built its back on. You know, like if you just threw it, like, you know, picked a random book out of your long box that wasn't made in the past 25 years, it would probably read just like this. You know, maybe not exactly like this, because I do think there are distinctions to this title that shows what Wells brings that's special to the table. I think that the emphasis on Peter here and his empathy as a character and the kind of humanization of all these people is something that Wells is uniquely good at, which is why it's so strange when we get away from things like this, because this seems so much his MO. And when he does it, this book sings. To me, that's what's special about an issue like this. It's not trying to, like, you know, reinvent the wheel or do anything really big with the character. And maybe it will ultimately. I doubt it. It seems like a fun side story. But honestly, like these are the kind of books that this title does best with. I mean, even going to the Dan Slott, as much as we praise things like Spider Island, it's like the two-part stories that are really the ones that I think are always the best. And I'm hoping for that from whatever's going on in this two-part story, because I thought this was a really solid, like one of the better issues of Amazing Spider-Man that we've gotten in quite a while.
This book, better than others that we've gotten in the past few months, did a good job of kind of having heightened superhero stuff going on, but also still being grounded in Peter's world. You know what I mean? Like they were both high stakes and small stakes at play here. And I think that's kind of the balance that you ultimately want to look for in a Spider-Man book like this. And it does kind of beg the question, Dan, like why is this so hard to get now? You know what I mean? I'm not trying to judge, you know, the critical reaction to this comic based on what showed up in my timeline on social media, but it seemed like there was a good reaction to this comic. So why aren't we doing more of this? Like, what do you think's going on?
I mean, there's really only like kind of two things that I can think of really is like, it's either like hubris on the writer's part, like that the writer, like all these writers that come on this book want their big story and feel driven to like shake up Spider-Man's world with these events, or that editorial feels like these books don't sell when compared to books that have big moments or can more like broadly support the line by doing like, you know, big event like thing. But I do feel like even your kind of like stories that are in between this that aren't events are kind of sold like events. Like, it's like, you know, we make fun of Nick Lowe, but it's like every other issue is going to change the world irrevocably. You know, this will be the greatest issue since Amazing Spider-Man number one. And I don't feel like that kind of salesmanship is put on, like that pressure is put on an issue like this. I guess it's good. I don't know if it sells better or worse, but like, this is the kind of thing I would tell people to pick up the run for, but maybe that's just like we're in our echo chamber over like what makes the Spider-Man book good.
I would say that more like this would probably lead to sales and not dips in sales like we've been seeing, I think, since Gang War has been kind of trudging along. But I, you know, I digress.
I mean, Gang War sold gangbusters, you know, so like
But I did see a little bit of a drop. I thought I saw a bit of a drop towards the end, unless I'm not looking at the same numbers. I don't know.
Like, I mean, I didn't keep up with it that closely. I just know that it was still riding top of the charts, you know.
Okay. So, well, who knows? Anyway, let's talk about some of the check-ins themselves and kind of the ramifications of it. I mean, like, you know, I've been poking fun a little bit at it, but like, I mean, the Aunt Anna stuff. Now, I vaguely remember seeing something about this. I don't know if it was during like the one of the backups in the wedding issue that we got last summer or what. But like, is this something? Did you get the full context of what's going on with Aunt Anna?
You know, Mark, I know you're not reading the X-Men line, but during the latest Hellfire Gala, the X-Men's big enemy of the Krakoan Age is this group called Orcus that is like trying to wipe mutants off the face of the earth, like, you know, like it's Tuesday. You know, part of their plan with the help of I believe it's a Mr. Sinister variant named Dr. Stasis or something like that. I'm reading these, I swear, but it's a lot to keep up with. He basically like took the Krakoan medicine that is like a big like thing at the forefront of that run, which is like the X-Men have cured all disease and are basically trying to like engender support for mutants by, you know, shipping these drugs all over the world. But like apparently Mr. Sinister or some variation on him like embedded a like bad element into that he could trigger whenever he wanted. And so they pulled their master plan as they attacked Krakoa with Iron Man-inspired sentinels and basically turned this drug and weaponized it so that all of humanity was injured in some way and everybody turns on the mutants and it's going to cause their downfall, which is currently playing out in the comics and will lead to the reboot of the line. And so Aunt Anna, who we like off panel were told has dementia, is now suffering at the result of this like triggering of this drug. And so now she is got Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, Krakoan derangement syndrome. She's at Ravencroft. I don't know why she gets a special designate of being at Ravencroft. And there's not just like a big facility on some island off of New York where everybody is dealing with this. Anyway, it was nice to follow up on it. I mean, that was like I believe it was like in a backup of an issue.
Of the annuals or something, like the Hallows Eve annual? Or I'm trying to remember. I remember seeing it. I just don't remember where.
Yeah, honestly, we covered it, but I can't remember what issue it was in the back of. You know, she kind of just launched into this insane thing out of nowhere. And I think it even predated the Hellfire Gala, so it was like kind of maybe the first sign that something was wrong with that medicine, which doesn't really, I think, make sense in the X-Men timeline, but whatever. She's at Ravencroft now. They even, I think, advertised this issue as like, we're following up on a thread you thought was forgotten. And I don't know which one they're referring to, if it was this or any of the other number of threads that weave in here. But I don't know. Did it still read okay for you if you didn't know anything about the Krakoan stuff?
I mean, yeah, I guess. I mean, like, I was able to jump in. I mean, it's still kind of on its face absurd. Although, like, I feel like the arc of how it was kind of charted out in this comic was at least, I feel, well executed, despite kind of the absurd premise of it. I mean, like, look, this is comics. I'm not trying to say that, like, characters getting, you know, derangement syndromes is out of the norm. Certainly it's not, but like, I mean, you know, you don't generally think of like, let's add some layers of depth and drama to Anna Watson. You know, like it's just it feels a little random. I guess this is kind of where I'm at with it. But like, I feel like they played it well, and like her kind of, you know, coming, her come to Jesus about it in light of her cure and being like, but no, it's my responsibility to stay here. I mean, I thought that was a good character beat, and kind of, you know, Peter like, oh, is that what I sound like? You know, I enjoyed that whole interaction.
But I mean, then, when was the last time we even saw this character outside of that backup? I mean, they clearly play her for a joke, right? Like she's like all like, prissed off and talking about doilies, you know, like this isn't anybody treating this as like a grand epic Marvel tale. It's a nice little side story that I agree with you, I thought was handled with real great sensitivity, you know, for the, at least Peter's character in it. Aunt Anna looks weirdly more like Mary or Aunt May than she does Anna Watson, who last time I remember had like a short bob and was overweight, but whatever, you know, Ozempic.
You're right, though. This wasn't like Aunt May needing the serum and Master Planner. You know what I mean? This was a little lighter in tone. But you did allude to some other storylines that felt kind of put away or forgotten or whatever that seemed to come up. In fact, like you know, not to reveal the sausage making, but you point some out in the notes here, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. That was in 900. Kirk Connors and the living brain kind of being woven back into the fabric here. What was your takeaway from that, if anything?
The fandom wiki does designate this as the Ultra Living Brain, which is not something I think was on the page. You know, in issue 900, which I think, you know, at the time we felt was incredibly random in terms of its insertion in the run, feeling like this evergreen Spider-Man tale after getting a very specific time and place story that kicked off this run. You know, I honestly, like, I was okay with memory holing issue 900, but I'm also equally okay with it coming back. Like, okay, cool. Like, you know, at least this, like, it's consistent. And, you know, as much as I've had problems with Wells' tonal jumps all over his run, like, I don't think he's really ever let something come up and then gone, I'm just going to throw it away. I mean, the Wreck Rap returns and stuff like that. You know, if this is a setup for another Gleason story that lets him conclude whatever this is, I'm okay with it. Last we saw the Ultra Living Brain, which is that giant green brain that had like a living brain, like human analog that we saw in issue 900 that disappeared. Black Cat was supposed to be like shepherding it away with the help of her two guys on her team to hide it somewhere so no one could get it. And I guess that means it went to Oscorp and in the hands of Kurt Connors, who is no longer the Lizard. He's just a dude with no arm now.
Who can keep track?
And what's that? Yeah, who can keep track? We'll see how consistent that is. But at least him and the Lizard being split was something that, like, I think Wells continued during Beyond. So, like, we can count on that at least for the time being, I hope. Let's put the world's most dangerous supercomputer in the hands of a guy who, last time Wells wrote him, ate his son. I don't know. Just another Oscorp thing, I guess.
There you go. Another Oscorp thing. I think, like, what really made this comic stand apart from certainly others that we've received in the last few months, and, you know, we've kind of alluded to this a few times already tonight, Dan, is the way Peter's character kind of comes across, specifically like his empathy for others. And you know, like, we you know, yes, we got that great scene with Anna and even with MJ and Jackpot, and it's like you're seeing this, like, you know, I don't want to call it like the Boy Scout side of him, because it's not quite that, but like it's just the real, genuine, sincere Peter who, you know, like, is recognizing his own flaws but also wants what's best for others and feels for them and looks into them. And it's like, it's, you know, not to ask the question again, but it's just like, why don't we get this Peter all the time? This is the best version of Peter. Like, this is the Peter I want. This Peter can still make dumb mistakes, but like there's a realness to it.
I always joke that the writer Jeff Lemire is like 12 different people, just because he has such tremendous output. Like, I feel like it's a team of people that call themselves Jeff Lemire. But, like, I'm beginning to think the same about Wells, too. Not that he has the same level of output that's as anywhere near as quality as Jeff Lemire's work is. This run is the tale of, like, one guy with four different personalities or writing styles. And I think that's the biggest detriment to this run overall, because, like, this is my favorite Zeb Wells. This is the Zeb Wells of World Without Love that had Peter empathically go into Tombstone's home and kind of let him off the hook and empathize with him. Like, if there's one defining attribute of how I like Wells's Peter, it's this. It's the empathy. And it's here in spades. And I don't know how a writer writes this and then turns this off. You know, when it's such a strong presence here, is just the elegance and there's like a Superman quality to this. Like, it reads like a good writing of Superman.
You still can get drama from this. I mean, I think his whole interaction with Sandman kind of was evidence of that. I mean, he's like, he's trying to relate and empathize with Sandman, and it almost backfires. I mean, it you know, just like talking, you know, like, hey, my friend Spider-Man sent me, like, you know, he's trying to have this real moment with him, and, you know, it triggers something in Sandman that almost becomes violent, but, you know, because he's in Ravencroft, it doesn't end up that way. But, like, you can't say, well, no, we can't have that because there's no drama in Peter doing that. And there's plenty of, like, it's right there. You know what I mean? Like, you can still make mistakes and be empathetic. It's just like, I feel more inherent to the character. Like you said, I don't get how someone would turn it off. I don't know why they would want to turn it off, because it's just like, I you know, again, like, of all the characters in the Marvel repertoire, I always feel like Peter is so character driven and so personality driven in what he does and why he does it. So it just kind of befuddles me. What did you get from his interaction with Norman Osborn here? I mean, Norman's back. We're still, I guess, kind of building to him breaking bad again, but they're still trying to kind of sell the moment of, hey, we're buddies. I don't know. What did you think about it?
I mean, the Norman stuff has, like, throughout the run often been a lot of telling rather than showing, you know, or if it does show, it kind of, like, hits the same note over and over again. And even this feels like a little bit of a note we've heard before. And yet I'm always willing to give it the benefit of the doubt, because these scenes tend to be so well written, like, in terms of just, like, two characters kind of, like, being open with each other. But what makes this one, I think, special versus the ones in the past is we now know that the Goblin is back. And so, like, you know, I think we suspected that in previous interactions before the kind of, like, finish line was moved a little bit. You know, like, I think before we thought, oh, anything could trigger, you know, the Goblin to coming back. And then it was like, oh no, he actually has to get stabbed with the spear and the, you know, which actually ended up not being true either. They just kind of can't return to him his goblin sins, or anyway, the less said about that confusingness, the better. But, like, now we know for sure, until the goalpost gets moved again, but I don't think it is going to. We've seen Amazing Spider-Man 50's cover has the Goblin on it. Like, you know, the Goblin is coming back. So, like, Norman's sincerity here, we don't know what to make of it, because it could be operating like it was back in the Ditko and Lee and Romita era, where it's a switch flip, you know, and, like, he could turn Goblin any moment, or it's something far more sinister and deceptive, you know, that is going on here. So I like the way you put it, hand wave about the gang war. Fine. You know, like, I can't hold every Spider-Man story to keeping up with every sub story. That's never been true in the history of this 1,000-issue run. I do think this is kind of like a kind of falsely earned moment. You know, it's like, you know, like, there's too much Spider-Man stuff going on in the company. And it's like, wasn't Norman the one that built that suit? And, like, you know, how much of a true distraction was it? They seemed, you know, like pretty gung-ho about the whole thing. But whatever, I'm willing to buy it. You know, I don't really know what this scene does for their relationship, really. It's kind of a minor scene. But it was empathically written, and I thought the artwork like sold these two kind of, you know, like open-hearted human beings, whether it's real or not.
Yes, I'm willing to buy it. They really need to start setting up what's happening, I think, a little bit more clearly. I mean, I know, you know, not to poke fun of you for being ahead of the solicitation stand, but like, yes, you saw issue 50's got the goblin on it, but like, maybe not everybody knows that who's reading this. So like, you know, it was like, there was nothing in this that like, I think there would be more tragedy to Peter kind of having this like, oh, shucks, you know, you've just come so far, Norman, if it was set up within this issue with like another, like a really clear reminder that like, but the goblin is a little more prevalent than it used to be with Norman. You know what I mean? Like it felt a little repetitive and flat, because I don't feel like they're relying on you readers like you, I think, rather than maybe someone just kind of going into this being like, okay, what is the actual drama happening here? I don't know if that was clearly conveyed in a way if you weren't like up on what's happening in a couple of months. So
yeah, I totally get that, and I think that's absolutely fair, you know, to potentially lay at the feet of this book. You know, to me the point of the scene, and again, this is not me letting the scene off the hook, because I agree with you, but I think the point of the scene, if I had to guess what the point of the scene is like, we're seeing Peter like letting his guard down, like his relationship with Norman is no longer about him being there to make sure Norman doesn't turn into the goblin. He's like legitimately friends with the guy and thinks the guy has his best interest at heart.
Right. Which is going to make the inevitable betrayal that much deeper, if that's the direction it goes, which I think is probably the sensible direction of this whole alliance from the get-go. I mean, you know, for all the people who are like, how could you make them friends? Because when they're not friends anymore, it's going to be that much harder on Peter. You know what I mean? Like, that's why you do this.
But and genuinely, this is probably the most interesting thing done with Norman in an age's time. You know, like, I could have read, you know, as much as we say it's repeating, I think there's still an endless number of stories you could get out of good guy Norman.
So, you know, in addition to Norman, not that we didn't necessarily get Mary Jane Watson in Gang War, she did kind of, you know, show up at the very, very end, like, here comes the cavalry. But I mean, we have more of a moment between Peter and her than we've probably had since, what, Dead Languages at this point? What was your take on that whole exchange?
I kind of love this, Mark. I'm not going to lie. I know you're like kind of being snarky about like her being a superhero, and I agree with that. But if it was going to be handled this way versus how it was handled in the Jackpot one shot, where it's like two awkward people reconnecting that were like ex-lovers and now are operating at like they're both working at the same place, you know, which is kind of like what I would treat it like, you know, like, I thought this was really funny. The undressing scene was a really nice touch. And like him trying to be supportive of her in a kind of awkward way. If you're going to do best friend MJ, but like with like a past, you know, that has a reason for her to keep showing up in the book. Like, I kind of like this. Like, I don't expect the Jackpot thing to be there for a long time. And I would have handled that one shot differently. But if this is like a temporary update to like their status quo and you want to get the most awkward and interesting stories out of it, like, honestly, if you were going to write scenes like this, I would have taken the pill that is MJ is a superhero much more softly if this was how it was written on the page.
I see that to a degree. I mean, I guess I also look at a scene like this and kind of what we saw between these characters, which, like you said, it was more about just genuine friendship and doing what's right for each other and being there for each other. Does having MJ be in a costume with powers, does that change anything about what's inherent about, you know, inherently good and enjoyable about that scene? I don't know if it does. And then, you know, and it kind of brings you back to like, so then why is MJ have powers again Well, you know, like, because there's going to be a miniseries. I don't know. Like, I'm still like at a loss of like, why does this need to happen with this character to propel things right now? Because it just seems like it's an experiment. Let's do a little of this. Let's do a little of that. And I'm not as far into it as I'm not saying that you're like super into it, but I'm just saying like I'm much more guarded about it, and you know, like looking at it, I think a little more cynically, because it doesn't fully work still for me. You know, it was I enjoyed this scene immensely, because it was, like I said, it was just nice to see the two of them, and I mean, you know, they kind of, I don't want to say ruined it, but you know, they did kind of go back to that well in Ravencroft, where it's like, oh, they used to date, blah 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 blah, like. I don't want to deal with that anymore. Let them be friends and have this relationship and do the things without having to keep like poking the bear. I think about, well, you know, they were together, and I think that's where it's also coming down for me too. It's like, let's just, if this is what we want the status quo to be, then let's just do this. If they're going to constantly, you know, if the status quo is like, no, we want them to be these like ill-fated lovers. Okay, but like, you know, you're gonna get a lot of unhappy people over that, you know, like, you know, to constantly be, you know, knocking at that hornet's nest, if you will. So I would be far more intrigued with these two characters right now to get just genuine friendship and support without the baggage of the relationship history than kind of constantly kind of name checking the fact that they were together. That's just, I think, where I kind of fall on it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think like, you know, I lay it out in that Substack, like how I felt like it could work, you know, if this is the evolution from the Nick Spencer run, which is like like showed her kind of coming into her own as Spider-Man's girlfriend. And now she's leveled up to being a superhero and she can truly be like on his level. And what would that mean for them? And I think there's a lot of interesting things to explore in there, even following who MJ is as a character. I think the problem is, and you pointed this out, is that the book is all over the place. You know, like you could dedicate a whole run or a whole like half of a run to, you know, MJ the superhero, and how does that change Peter's attitude towards her, and what's their new working relationship, you know? And like, I'm not happy getting the crumbs that we're getting. I just liked this particular crumb. And that's the thing I think you could say about the Wells run, is that it does seem all over the place. A lot of great ideas, but like very few of them has stuck consistently, you know, or been the thing that looked like he clearly wanted to explore. You know, reading this, I'm like, oh, like he is interested in what I think he's interested in regarding this relationship, but like with so few pages dedicated to it, it's hard for anyone to truly grasp, you know, where it's ultimately going or what it's trying to explore thematically. And maybe the run will close out with a grand statement on it. I don't know.
Well, you alluded to the Substack just a few minutes ago, Dan, in your talk about MJ. Do we want to talk about what else is in the Substack, or what the Substack is in this context?
Yeah, sure, Mark. The Substack is our regular newsletter where Mark and I discuss all the things that we couldn't discuss on the show. I know, shock. There's more things to talk about Spider-Man that we're not talking about on our already too long show. But yeah, I mean, things like Mary Jane, we did a whole thing about like that character and the state of Mary Jane. And we just did one on like Gang War as an event that we mentioned on a recent review. I guess the last review that we did, but we got one coming up, Mark. What are we going to be talking about soon on the Substack?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to focus a lot about Miles Morales, specifically with the most recent Spectacular Spider-Men series that launched, which paired off Miles and Peter. I mean, we also have Miles 300 coming up in a couple of weeks, which, you know, will whet your appetite for Miles. And I am gonna do a little trip down memory lane. Obviously, Dan, you're welcome to join in on the trip down memory lane about my acquisition of Ultimate Fallout number 4, which really wasn't that exciting of it. I mean, I just bought it at the newsstand. We were at the comic book store the week it came out. But like, there was a lot behind it, and you know, it was a very interesting time to be buying that comic for sure, based on some of the discourse about that, which I would like to get into in the Substack.
If you're interested in reading about any of those things, check out our Substack. You can go to amazingspider.substack.com. There's also a link in the description of this episode, and it will take you right there. You can sign up and you'll get the newsletter every couple of weeks from us discussing new Spider-Man events as we want to talk about them. So speaking of talking about Spider-Man, that's what we're here to do on this show. Let's get back to our discussion of issue 45.
So Dan, you have a note here that I got to be honest, I forgot about this. Yeah, we towards the end, we see Sandman in Ravencroft, but he is introduced up, or I should say Peter introduces himself and asks if he is William Baker, which is not Flint Marko, how I know Sandman. What's the deal? Give us the scoop, Dan.
Yeah, I don't remember when this was like first introduced, but I think it was first fully fleshed out in a story that Peter David did in Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man Annual Number 1 back in the aughts, where it kind of gave the backstory to Flint Marko, or like an alternate backstory to Flint Marko, which is to say that Flint Marko is not actually his real name. His real name is William Baker. As a kid, he was, shock and awe bullied. And so he wanted to take on a name to kind of go with this gang that would like make him seem tougher. And so he chose the name Flint. And I believe Marko comes from like his like stepfather or something like that, you know, who probably was an alcoholic and abused him, as all these villains tend to be children of. But you can read that in that issue by Peter David. The implication there is that like there are, and we've seen this play out through, I think, a bunch of modern Sandman stories. I think even Zeb Wells wrote stories about it before, back when he was doing stuff, those kind of smaller stories that he appeared here and there for over the past 20, 25 years, is that like Sandman has dissociative identity disorder, or I don't know if it's like technically that, but that he's made up of, as he puts it in this issue, many particles of sand, all of whom have different personalities. And we've seen that in the Chemius Castle story. I think we saw it more recently. I forget the name of the story, where in like Chip Zdarsky's Spectacular Spider-Man run, where there were like all of these different personalities of Sandman breaking up. And the core one is William Baker, and Flint Marko is like the evil tough guy one. And there's many different backstories to Sandman. This is one of them. I'm not particularly partial to it. I've just seen that name appear over the years. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was like, where did that come from? Like, I don't remember the specifics on it. So that's what the only reason it was fresh in my mind. I think it came up when I was doing a reread of something and was like, why is everybody calling him William Baker? And man, if there was a time for an editorial note, I imagine this would be it, because I imagine a lot of people were like, I'm very aware of Flint Marko. Why am I not aware of William Baker?
Now, you only get one editor's note per issue, Dan, and we got it for Krakoan derangement syndrome. So, that was our quota. No, I had to be honest. I did not recall any of that in terms of the different names and stuff. So good on you for reminding us. I mean, it was good to see Sandman here, even if like I feel like some of the syntax of what the character was saying was a little weird, like specifically the ending, which was the...
Yeah, let's talk about that ending, because I agree with you. Nice scene with Sandman. We've said empathic, well-illustrated, like cool to see this character back in the comic. Cool. The ending of this book, I'm like, what?
Yeah, I mean, it's just... I mean, you know, kind of like word salad here, which I don't know if that's by design or, you know, if we're dealing with like the Spider-Man Black Cat stuff again, where it was like, no, it was just that was just how it was written. We weren't trying to be symbolic with words. You know, he first refers to the bad sand wants Spider-Man out, like, okay, out. And then it's like, and they want him out too. And then we flash over to the Sinister Six and it's like, what? Like, I don't, I, like, what do you mean they want him out? That doesn't, Are
they trying to out him as like a gay man?
I don't know.
What is going on here? Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not like he didn't say they want you dead. They want him dead, or, you know, they want to get rid of Spider-Man. Like I said, this feels like it's language that's trying to be symbolic in a way, or cute. And it's just not, it didn't work. I guess I got the general gist, which is like, here's the Sinister Six and they're coming for him. Although, like, that doesn't necessarily make sense, because we've been getting this whole storyline with Otto right now in Superior, which, you know, doesn't seem to jive that he would be assembling the Six again. And Kraven's there. I guess he's over his fear or whatever it is. I mean, he's just, you know, gonna do Kraven stuff again, or Kraju, sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about Kraju is I thought there was a real opportunity for reform for that character at the end of Spidey's first hunt, right? Like, he had finally been freed from, you know, the sins of the father, and here he is just back on this team again. And my immediate thought was like, well, it's an Ed McGuinness story that's going to do this probably, and that means it's going to be some completely bizarre, out of continuity with the rest of the run thing. And I don't really know what the entanglements with the writer and the artist are that, like, when things, I know that Wells is likely writing a lot of this out of order, but it's like, it is weird. I mean, I know Doc Ock has kind of turned another corner in Superior, where we thought he was a good dude, and then it turned out, no, he was just using it as an opportunity to try to steal Peter's body again. So, like, okay, he's a bad guy, fine. It does seem weird to focus on that in this title when the other title is doing so much with it. And where, like, didn't Spider-Man team up with the Sinister Six in 900 and free them in some way from the clutches of the Living Brain? I don't know. I'm just like, I'm kind of over the Sinister Six for a while, and I'm ready to, like, not read about them. I won't mind it, but, like, it was not the, like, exciting. Going back to my first comment about this issue, I love the quiet, like, Peter Parker-focused ones. And to end a nice, quiet Peter Parker-focused story with the tease of, like, a big, brawly Sinister Six story, I'm just like, no, don't. Please, stop. Like, I don't need something like that. I just got a gang war, you know?
I cannot think for the life of me the last time we got what I would call a satisfying Sinister Six arc, you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like they are, you know, this has become like the Carnage and symbiote kind of crutch of creators. Like, okay, we gotta, you know, it's been 6 months, gotta bring the Six back to do something. And it's just like, all right, now what? You know, like Spidey's got this entire rogues gallery, you know, and, you know, I think I would much rather see a well-defined evolution of a dynamic between Mysterio or Electro or any of those characters one-on-one versus, like, let's just get the Six together. They're going to kill Spider-Man. I don't know. Like, the whole thing just seems very tired to me. And yeah, like a bit of a bummer at the end of a issue that was otherwise kind of like, no, we're getting back to basics. You know, we're getting back to the core of this character. And, you know, this doesn't necessarily feel that.
All right, well, let's move from a big question mark possible negative to a major positive, which I thought the art in this book was stunning. I mean, Carmen Carnero is new to Amazing Spider-Man, but did Miles for a while, and it was just announced that she's leading like an X book, which is a shame because honestly, I want her on Amazing Spider-Man. Like, I thought this was a beautiful looking title. Her and Marcio Menez are doing amazing stuff in here. I thought she nailed it with the empathic Peter. I mean, you made fun of it a little bit in the recap, like how kind of like sincere Peter, like, you know, how much he looked at like Norman almost lovingly, right? But like, I don't know. I mean, even just like the images of like Peter, like as Spider-Man reaching over and putting his hand on Anna's shoulder and all of the people out of the costumes, I just thought everybody's faces were like just rich and full of emotion. And Menez, like, I mean, he's been nonstop strong, but this took me back to like reading him on like Amazing Spider-Man Volume 5, number 75, where that beginning of the Beyond, where I think he really kind of just like, not that he appeared out of nowhere because he was doing stuff in the Spencer run, but that was like a showpiece book for him. And there's that image of like Peter and Ben standing in that foyer at the college and the dappling of the shadows of leaves falling on them. And he brings that back out again here. And it's just like, man, if a colorist has the time to paint like all the leaves onto like the shadows on Spider, I mean, a beautiful book, beautiful book.
The pencil work itself, it actually kind of reminded me, and if you feel this is a bad comparison, please call me out for it, but it was kind of like, was it Stefano Caselli, I feel like, in terms of like, you know, it was like this, you know, nice hybrid of you know, kind of like, you know, a little more, I feel like it was a little grounded more in realism and trying to capture the characters out of costume. I mean, we didn't get a lot of costume Peter here for the most part, which I always felt like Caselli doing, like when he was kind of brought in after, you know, either Comancoli or Delgado, or not Delgado, Ramos would do something very, you know, kind of eclectic, you know, the kind of like show like the human side in Spider Island or some of his other issue or ends of the earth, things like that. So like I just liked how she kind of really focused in on that, like you said, the character work, the character faces, the expressions, the reactions. I mean, you know, the other thing I made fun of, but I part of the reason why I made fun of it was because the artwork really brought this out, the scene with MJ where he's, you could just tell like he's trying to be supportive, but like, you know, with the way his face is contorting, it's not quite, he's not quite there. You know what I mean? Which is, you know, maybe he's speaking for me too there. That was just kind of where I was brought to when reading it. I mean, it's such a different, like if we're not going to get JRJR or Gleason, like, I mean, McGinnis was growing on me, but I prefer this to McGinnis. I got to be honest. Like, I feel like this is more true to Spider-Man in its own way.
I think it's also truer to Zeb's interests, you know, like we've seen, I mean, we've talked about Zeb being four different writers, but it's really Zeb being a different writer for each artist, you know, which like, I think is like a good attribute to have as a comic book writer is to like adapt to your artist and their strengths, you know, which then means like the placement of artists on a rotating book like Spider-Man is super important. And as much as McGinnis has his strengths, I don't think he meshes with the other artists on this title. And, you know, you get someone like Carmen Carnero who just comes in and like just, this just is like Zeb, the most Zeb Wells has been Zeb Wells since like the early JRJR stuff. And so like, I just think she fit this title like a glove, and I'm sad. I mean, I'm sure she'll do great stuff for X-Men, but like this is a great, she balances the kind of like goofy superhero dramatics and stuff, like her expressive Spider-Man mask and things like that, with the grounded nature and big emotional, you know, characters here. Like I loved it. And she's been doing great stuff on Miles, which I think prepped her for this. And as to the Caselli thing, like I see that. I think both have a fairly like European inking style. And it's notable that Carnero does her own inks on this, because I think they very beautifully match her style, which is to say like varying line widths that like really curve and bring out like a kind of like weighted emotion in these characters. When I think of Caselli, I think a lot about like the details on the costume and how much he would put into that. And I think Carnero doesn't do that quite as much, but like the details are there on the human faces. And I thought it was just really, really beautiful. I love having JRJR on the book, but there is something to say about like having an old legend on the book that doesn't like leave room to bring a ton of new voices. I think, you know, for all of the faults of like Nick Lowe, I do think he's been able to get a lot of new voices on ASM that just like immediately are showstoppers, you know. Like, I know we've got Vincentini on Miles right now, but like that dude came in and did just a couple issues of Amazing Spider-Man and then moved on.
Regardless of whether the art jives with the writer or whatever, the book rarely looks bad. And, you know, like I think this is a continuance of that. The book looks good here, you know, but like it also happens to really jive with Zeb. So double bonus. I mean, she'll go to X-Men, but you never know. You can get her again at some point.
And also just to have like a female artist on the book and bringing whatever sensibilities come with that. Yeah. And I don't want to lean into any stereotypes like that women are more empathic than men. But like if that's the case, there's a sensibility here that feels very unique to Carmen, if it were. Yeah. All right. So let's get to grades. Mark, what are you giving this one?
This is tough. This is probably going to feel lower than it should be, or maybe you're going to come in and be at the same grade as me. I'm going to feel silly for saying this, but I'm giving this a C+. I still think I enjoyed this, but it's just slightly above average. And I just don't want to give into the curve, Dan. C+.
I gotta say, I really enjoyed this book. It's a B for me. I just loved being in Peter's head. And I know that that's like something we should not be praising necessarily because all the books should be doing it. But right. I do think that this book leans into a specific thing that Wells does better than a lot of other writers have done on this title, which is empathic Peter. And to get a few scenes of that, I think elevated this title to a B for me.
Okay, I think that's fair. I almost went B minus, but you know. Anyway, all right. So,
I'm all over the place, Mark. Yeah,
you're just a friendly guy. But in the meantime, it's that time for all good things to come to an end. So we want to say thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for tuning in to this episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
Yeah, this podcast exists because of listener support on Patreon. We've been losing a few Patreons recently, so we would love to have you guys back on. I think people are maybe souring on this run, but hopefully you're not souring on us. Which is to say, for only $3.99 a month, you can help support our show's existence while getting early episodes, including these reviews the same weeks the comics release, exclusive artwork, and a ton of other bonuses. So thank you to everyone who already supports us and the work that we do.
Yeah, Dan, you can't even blame like me starting fights on Twitter for losing it unless you count me insulting the fans of Shocker the other night. Did you see that? That was
I did. I wandered into you throwing strays at Shocker.
I just joked and referred to him as off-brand Electro, and I was getting ratioed for that. I mean, it's the first time I've been ratioed in a long time on Twitter, probably since the Dead Languages arc. So, you know, I'm glad that Shocker, you know, and it's vibrating. It's not electricity. I know it's not electricity.
And he's not the vibrator, even though he's got a big V on his belt. His whole costume is a V theme.
Yeah, and he's yellow netting, but whatever. Hey, go Herman. Go Herman Schultz.
To keep this extended, like, I thought you were a bigger fan of the Shocker than you suggested there. Like, I thought of the two of us, you were the homer for Shocker. Oh,
I mean, the joke was, for context, I post comics on Instagram and on Twitter just from my collection. I posted Amazing Spider-Man 46, the first Shocker. And like, I wrote, all these years later, I'm not convinced if Shocker's actually a good villain creation. And like, I think that's a fair statement. I mean, like, he's a Romita villain. It's kind of cool. He's been used a lot, but like, is he actually a good villain creation? I don't know. I mean, like, he's kind of yes, he's not electricity, but it's a variant of Electro. He's got whatever. I don't know what to tell you, Dan.
But he's got like gauntlets where he pushes a button, and that's like, honestly, I think he's a better villain than Electro. I'm going to come out and say he's a more Spider-Man appropriate villain than Electro. Like, he is a science creation, and he has mechanics to his suit. To me, that screams Spider-Man more than guy imbued with godlike electricity powers. But, you know, like, that's a fight for another day, I guess.
Absolutely, Dan. All right. Well, anyway, Dan and I really want to increase all the awesome work we do in 2024, like these arguments. So if you're already a patron or want to become one, please help us meet our goals and make this a better podcast by considering supporting our show. Just go to amazingspidertalk.com and click on the big old Patreon button to get started.
Awesome. Well, this podcast episode was edited by Rick Coast, who I'm sure is loving hearing all of these side tangents that are finding its way into the show. The video version of the show is available on YouTube and was edited by Alex Galucki. Our artwork comes handcrafted by artists Ron Friend, Sal Buscema, and Nick Cagnetti. Our theme songs were produced by Rylan Bojack, Tony Thaxton, and Spider Madge, and our animated intro was created and performed by Josh Sutton. Don't forget to subscribe to our Amazing Spider Talk Substack. We're going to be covering Spectacular Spider-Men this week. So if you want to keep up with our thoughts on that story, that's the place to go, amazingspider.substack.com. So Mark, until you and I both awkwardly undress around each other again, what's our motto?
With great podcasts, there must also come the Amazing Spider Talk.
I'm going to let that hang out there and let people wonder the context for that.
I mean, I was going to say we could have also used awkwardly, like, ask me for money at a con to buy art from Mark Bagley. But, you know,
there you go. There you go.